welcome to Conscious Chatter, where what we wear matters. I'm Kestrel Jenkins, your host and the founder of Aware World. Over the last 10 years, fashion consumption has increased a whopping 60%. But let's think about this. How long do you keep all the clothes in your closet? Do you purge sometimes? What about all your friends out there with overflowing wardrobes? When we buy more, we have more. And then down the line, we have to cleanse because honestly, there just isn't enough room for all the stuff. It's key for us all to remember that when we, quote, get rid of the no longer loved garments, they don't just go away. We talked about waste in episode 5 with author Elizabeth Klein, but all the issues around textile buildup could take episodes to address. This week, we have the treat of speaking with the woman behind this amazing quote. Today, buying a dress is like buying a Big Mac. Cheap, fast, and judging by the poor quality seen in fast fashion clothes, not very healthy. Christina Dean is the founder of Redress, a Hong Kong-based environmental NGO working to reduce waste in the fashion industry. Christina regularly speaks at seminars and has received a plethora of praise for her work, including being listed by UK Vogue as one of the UK's top 30 inspirational women, and being named one of 2010's most influential women in green by online magazine Coco Eco. So, Christina, thanks for joining me today.
It's a pleasure. It's very nice to be here.
I'm pretty humbled to chat with you. I've been reading about you and following your journey for years now, I feel like. And as a lot of my listeners would know, I'm a lover of stories, especially when it comes from people that have experienced it. So can you kind of share a little bit about your personal journey and what kind of led you to become such an influencer in the sustainable fashion space?
Sure. Well, if you like stories, then I've definitely got one for you, because I used to be what I would say a very normal fashion consumer, i.e., you know, I used to just buy what I liked. I bought quite willy-nilly, quite unconsciously, actually. I didn't actually think about the environment, didn't really think much about clothes other than whether I liked them or not and could afford them. And then I also, at that time growing up, I actually went into the medical world and dental world, i.e. I used to be a dentist. And so I worked for a couple of years in the UK as a dentist and basically absolutely hated it, just because, you know, dentistry is actually a very, very stressful job. I don't know the suicide stats, but, you know, dentists are way up there on the stress and even suicide level. It's really a very, very stressful job. And so I decided to give it up, and that was an easy decision. And I retrained then as a journalist. And at the same time, my family and I decided that we were going to move to Hong Kong to just have an adventure. And so when I first came to Hong Kong, which was about 11 years ago, I was then a qualified journalist. And I wrote for the many publications, mostly the South China Morning Post, writing about issues that I was interested in. And back then, you know, I had an interest in the environment, but I wasn't like a tree hugger. You know, I wrote as much about my sex life and, you know, beauty products and where to get the best haircut and where you could, you know, go on holiday with your kids as I did the environment. But I started to home in on the environment because basically I moved to one of the filthiest places in the world. And, you know, I am quite I'm quite an outward-looking person, and I was just thinking, what the hell is going on with this bloody country of China? It's so filthy. We have disgusting air, disgusting water. China is revoltingly polluted. And I kept worrying about it and thinking about it. And it was really through my thought process that I decided to write more and more about the environment. And because basically, I mean, the great thing about being a journalist is you just write whatever you want. You know, if you want to get a great haircut, write about it and you'll get the best hairdresser to do it for you. And I decided that I was really interested in the environment in China. So I just basically started to write more and more about it. And it was through my journalism that I started to dig deep. And, you know, I was a well-trained journalist and I was actually extremely good at research back then, and probably not anymore. And I really just discovered way too much. And I was horrified, truly, truly horrified. I was like a detective for stats. And I remember going out for dinner one night with my husband and I was having a great glass of Chardonnay. I remember it so well. And just telling him about all these awful things that I'd read about. And I said, you know, no one's doing anything about this. And he said, well, why don't you do something about it? And I thought, really? And he really encouraged me to start Redress. And the reason I started in the fashion industry, even though I had no experience on it, is because China produces so much of the world's clothes and textiles, and because the fashion industry and the textile industry is the second biggest global polluter. So that's how it all kind of came about, that this completely dentally trained, journalistically trained fashion virgin actually ended up starting an NGO trying to reduce waste in the fashion industry.
Wow, what an incredible story.
Yeah, well, I never actually expected the story to carry on. I thought that it would just be a small project and maybe raise a little bit of awareness in Hong Kong. And I thought, well, you know, I'll do a couple of events and, you know, talk about it and we'll see what happens. I never, ever, 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 ever thought I would be doing it 11 years on. And I never thought I would dedicate the rest of my career and my life to something as, back then it was relatively niche to talk about sustainability in the fashion industry, but now obviously it's widespread. I just never thought that that would happen to me.
Yeah, it's incredible. So with Redress, you focus, it seems like, a lot on waste and kind of like this throwaway culture, I feel like, is something that keeps coming up in conversation for me lately. And often it's thrown around, but I don't think we really always understand it or really absorb what it means. And I've read some of your stats, like you mentioned that you just love the statistics, and I was really absorbing them actually on your website recently. And one of them that struck me was that in China, it's estimated that 26 million tons of industry and consumer textile waste is generated each year.
Yes.
And in Hong Kong, you said basically it's like 11,000 garments entering the landfill per hour.
Could be. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think when it comes to waste, I mean, the good news is consumers are now beginning to understand waste, but a lot of the focus is around when we think about waste and from a consumer perspective, they think about old clothes and not even old, actually, new clothes sometimes. So the issue of clothing waste is really becoming much more paramount now because there's no denying the fact that we've been buying a ridiculous amount of clothes and chucking them out. So that's kind of, in inverted commas, obvious. Now, what is not obvious to consumers who, you know, might not be thinking about it is that there's a lot more waste that comes with a t-shirt. Most people can't even imagine. And that waste starts at the bottom of the supply chain. So from, you know, when the cotton's grown, when the cotton's produced, the yarn stage, when the yarn is woven or knitted, whatever, into a fabric. And then as it's cut and sewn, and then so you get waste that could be even a little tiny fiber fluffing around in the factory, to the wasting in trimmings, buttons, zippers, to the fabric. And then you get waste in terms of water, energy, greenhouse gases, diesel, fuel, plastic, packaging. Like, there is so much waste that comes with the fashion industry that's way beyond just the t-shirt itself. So what, I mean, in an ideal world, if consumers could think more clearly about waste, they would kind of take the blinkers off their eyes and say to themselves, we are not just looking at the physical post-consumer waste, i.e., you know, the finished garment that I'm chucking away because I don't like it anymore. There is a huge legacy of waste that is happening somewhere, and I can tell you it's happening on my doorstep. That's why I know about it. There's a lot of waste that you can't see that was created because of that one t-shirt. So that's what I feel is the next step in kind of consumer consciousness. You know, I say great, fantastic, people are caring about post-consumer clothing waste, fantastic, because we know that that's become a huge problem. But my wish is that people could understand that there is huge waste that's locked away in factories and in developing countries and in these places that we don't actually know. And that waste is having a massive planetary impact on the people and on the earth's health. So it's like you need to imagine where your t-shirts come from before you even receive it. And there, yeah, that's the waste I'm also interested in, is the supply chain waste.
Yeah, exactly. And not on the supply chain, but in kind of like the after the garment goes to the landfill. There was just an article that was in the Huffington Post recently, which was about why we should never throw old clothes in the trash. So it's going back to that kind of consumer education. But he was talking about how when the clothes decompose, they release landfill gas, as he called it. So just like toxic pollutants that are going out into the air, which is something that I feel like also doesn't really get addressed very often.
Yeah, that's also true. I mean, the breakdown of all sorts of materials in landfills creates nasty gases, which, you know, contribute to climate change. I think I'm not an expert on all these gases, but I would say that, you know, depending on which landfill you're talking about, some landfills actually just catch that. So they're actually covered in a plastic that sort of catches those gases, and some of them even convert that into energy. So it really kind of depends on how classy your landfill is. You know, I've got an obsession with landfills, and because I live in Asia, unfortunately, I'm able to see them literally much more frequently than Western people. So this is kind of segueing to something, a different sort of story, but okay, I'll tell you, I don't know if this is relevant, but when I was still a dentist and a qualified dentist, I've always had a very adventurous spirit, and I used to go and do free dental work all over Asia. So I would literally pack up my dental kit. I had a traveling surgery, basically, and I, it sounds crazy, but I used to go to provide free dentistry for people that couldn't afford even a toothbrush and certainly could not afford to go to the dentist. And so the reason I'm saying that is I used to actually do dentistry around landfills in Asia, like Cambodia, Philippines. And, you know, you've got basically in these countries, really poor countries, you've got, you know, absolute communities. You've got villages that live either on top or beside of landfills. Now, that is just, in their circumstances, a landfill is literally just a mountain of rubbish. And so that will be producing all these noxious, bad gases because there's absolutely no control of how that waste is being degraded. I mean, it's that sad that the only control of these disgusting landfills are the children and the women, basically, and men, some men, who are picking the rubbish out of the landfill. That is kind of as controlled as they are. Now, segue to Hong Kong, where I've been to the landfills here. I mean, they're actually pretty sophisticated, nice looking mountains of rubbish, but they're very well managed mountains of rubbish, and they are covered. When they start to decompose, they actually cover them with a huge plastic tarpaulin and they capture the gases. So there's a spectrum of landfill horror stories. But one of the horror stories, and I'm sorry, I'm segueing back to textiles exclusively now, is one of my favorite statistics. And it's quite a shocking one. It's a little bit old, but I think it still proves the point, which is in the US, between 2000 and 2011, so let's just call, you know, roughly a decade, you know, from 2000 to 2011, the total solid municipal waste, which is basically a geeky term that says the total landfill mass, reduced by 1%. So that's quite a victory, I would say, for waste reduction to have come down by 1% over, let's just say, a decade. But during that same time period, textile waste increased by 38% within that time. So, yeah, I know, and that's kind of sad. I mean, I think it's more than sad. It's pretty foul because I think that, you know, as a global world, we have done a good job in raising awareness about metal recycling, paper recycling, glass recycling. You know, these are everyday consumables, you know, cans for food, glass for food, wine. So we've done pretty well on these daily materials, but textiles needs to catch up. And we need to be recycling much more textiles because, you know, some people drink wine like other people consume and chuck out clothes. So we should, as a world, be thinking much more about how we recycle textiles and not just about, you know, oh, I've got to recycle the paper, which we should still recycle the paper. But we need to, unfortunately, we need to let the textile component of our waste catch up with the rest of our awareness around paper. Now, what's really interesting to me, and which this should inspire people to recycle textiles more, is that after aluminium, recycling textiles has got the biggest environmental benefit. So it's more beneficial to recycle textiles than it is paper. And yet recycling paper is entrenched in our culture, which is brilliant. We like trees. We want to continue recycling. That's all good. But I'm just trying to say that the value and the importance of recycling textiles is not as ingrained as it should be.
Yeah, and I feel like it's one of those things that gets overlooked. And do you think it's because of infrastructure or education? Like, where do you think that we're missing, or is it all of it?
Well, it's all of it. But one of the real challenges I think we have right now is that it's very easy to recycle paper. You can do it at home. I mean, I smash it up, make it wet, lie it down again. Basically, you can recycle paper. I mean, obviously, that's a very easy way of doing it. But on an industrial scale, recycling post-consumer clothing waste is actually very difficult. So what we actually need is for businesses to start to be able to make money, and lots of it, hopefully, in recycling our clothing waste. And then what will happen is that there'll be more incentives and more push to get our clothes. So for me, what I want to see is a business solution to huge widespread recycling of our post-consumer clothing waste. And until we have that, I think that we're going to have a bit of a backlog, i.e. consumers should recycle all the time. But what we're beginning to see is a bit of a backlog, like what the hell do we do with the clothes? You know, Africa, I think, is going to be changing their regulations. They don't want to import anymore. And I want to just call it crap. I don't know if that's fair to say it, but I call it crap. Like, we are dumping, so many of the Western worlds are just dumping our clothes on other developing countries. And the fact that Africa is supposedly going to change their import regulations so that they won't accept clothing waste means they've got enough. And I actually, what's quite interesting is that quite a few people contact me, disgruntled factory workers and angry designers. And I get a lot of, I've even got a file on my desktop, you know, called Angry People. And they get in touch and they, you know, complain about X, Y, and Z. One of them I was quite interested in, I set up a call with him. He's a denim designer in Pakistan and he's furious about all the clothing imports that Pakistan is doing at the moment. He said, you know, in Karachi, there's just clothes everywhere that we've imported, basically, actually, he says, from the US. And he says, you know, people are now burning the clothes on the streets or, you know, in sort of dodgy looking factories, not sort of proper facilities, to extract the metal, to get the buttons and the zippers out, to sell that as a recyclable. Anyway, so my point is, I guess from using his example, is that he's absolutely furious that there's clothing waste all over his city. So coming back to what I'm saying, consumers, keep recycling your clothes. Yes, 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 yes. But we need the industry to give us a decent solution like they do for paper. Give us a solution where we can turn our old clothes into usable fibers again and again and again. And that is what the industry is obviously trying to do at the moment, but we're not really there yet. One thing I think is also really interesting is that one of the richest women in China, she's not at the moment, but she has been previously, she is famous and she's the richest woman in China, was, because she runs a paper recycling factory. Now, whoever can solve the million-dollar question about how to recycle post-consumer clothes will be richer than she is, because clothing fiber as a recyclable is worth much, 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 much more than paper as recyclable. So there's big money to be made here, and I can't wait until someone actually does it and finds a solution to the technical and sort of the mechanical way to recycle our clothes.
Yeah, wow. I mean, that's such a good point. It always so often comes back to the financial gains and how money will help make the shift. But I think that's, you know, it's like, can you change the system or do you work within the system? And it seems as though things can change faster if you can find ways to work in the system.
Absolutely. I mean, you need the market. The market needs to work. And if the market doesn't work, we have a problem. So I think it will happen. I definitely think it, well, yes, we will find a way to recycle these clothes. I mean, there's so much great innovation happening at the moment on a technical, scientific, sort of chemical level to try to recycle our clothes. I mean, the main differences between paper and clothes are pretty obvious. I mean, paper is just tree fiber. It's pretty easy. That's what it is. If you get a piece of toilet paper and a piece of printing paper, it's still tree fiber pretty much. It's just made differently. But if you look at all of our clothes, they're like a cocktail of everything. you know, polyester, cotton, wool, a blend of that, tencel, you name it. And then not only do you have the different fiber types, but you've got, you know, zippers, metal, studs. You, even in one garment, you could have three fabric types if you've got, you know, paneling or something. So what you've got for clothes is a bloody nightmare. Sorry about my awful language. And that is not as bad as it usually gets. But you know, with clothes, you're looking at a cocktail of mess. And so it's very difficult to just put all of those clothes into a Magimix and hope that you're going to get a new fiber out of it, because you can't do that. It all needs different chemical processing and mechanical processing. And what's really annoying about clothes is that you can't put, say, this, you can't put 100 pairs of jeans in this Magimix, in inverted commas, and hope for new fibers to come out, because all of the metal will break the machine. That means that you need humans to cut out the metal, and then that, who's going to pay for that? You know, so it becomes very, very, very difficult to recycle all this clothing waste, which kind of brings me back to the original point. Recycling clothing waste is a real nightmare. So we need to kind of control consumption and think about reducing and slowing down the entire sort of cycle of consumption. And that's really, I think, a lot of the solutions are controlling consumption.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've worked on so many consumer-directed campaigns, I feel like. I mean, I loved the 365 challenge and the whole concept of redress it, don't bin it behind it. And I followed all of it. I love it. And I feel like that got such a good response and you got massive amounts of press from it and just people were paying attention. So I'm wondering how much you feel like people pay attention and then actually put the ideas into action into their everyday lives.
Well, I think increasingly more and more, I'd say mainstream consumers, I don't really know how to define a mainstream consumer, but people probably like me and you, I think that they have had enough of clothes that don't last. So I feel when we're trying to say to people, you know, buy better, take care of it, enjoy fashion, love fashion, you know, you are what you wear, that concept of, you know, us as human beings, what, how we shop, how we dress, how we approach our entire closet is actually truly a reflection of who we are. And I think because people have had enough of the mainstream industry, which is fast, poorly made, basically not very nice, that it's very easy to convince people that there is a better way to enjoy fashion. So I don't think it's difficult. I think people are ready for that message, because you know what, again, I'm not a normal shopper anymore, but from what I hear, because I do talk to a lot of people about it, they're just kind of annoyed that, you know, you go into some sort of shops and you spend X, Y, or Z on a garment, but after one or two or three washes, it's not the garment that you bought anymore. And these clothes basically have a very short, slippery life from the shop counter to the bin because they're not well made. And that's just annoying. And I think more and more people are realizing that. And so that means that they're more open to better ways of consuming and wearing fashion.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had an episode with some bloggers that are connected to the conscious fashion world a couple of months back, and one of them is still a student, and she was saying that other students are asking her where they can get clothes because they're so annoyed by buying things from Forever 21 or H&M and then it just falling apart. And I felt really inspired by the fact that even the next younger generation is noticing that and being able to kind of realize that the quality isn't there and they're seeking something else.
Definitely. I think millennials are, you know, every sort of marketing person is after the millennial dollar because, you know, the millennials are taking over the entire planet. And millennials have very different values in terms of A, they expect and would demand that products are more ethically produced. So that's helping to drive a better way of production, because brands do listen to that. And secondly, I think, you know, building on from what you were saying, you know, the whole sharing economy is something that's kind of in the blood of younger millennials, because they've kind of grown up with a sharing economy being available to them, which means that they don't feel the need to own clothes as much as the older generation do. You know, if you look at like a 50-year-old in Hong Kong, we call them tai tais, they're basically rich women, you know, rich Chinese woman, she would never share her clothes with anybody. you know, like, share my clothes. You know, she'd be dripping with Gucci and wouldn't share her clothes. But then if you look at her daughter would be probably renting her clothes or renting clothes from another company or selling her own designer clothes online or even buying designer clothes online. So we've had a huge shift in that in a generation. So what that means for fashion is that there is a bigger market for A, more ethically produced clothes, and B, for sharing clothes, and C, not having to own clothes. And that means that if we don't need to own clothes, you can actually afford to spend more on items and share them more.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely see the sharing economy coming through. And as far as ordering pieces just to rent, it's so much more prominent now. And it makes sense because I feel like maybe it's not everyone, but a lot of people in my generation don't have that much space, especially if you live in a city or you don't own your own home. You have a small closet and you don't have that much space to put all of this stuff. And it just feels like a lot of people are really enjoying that freedom that comes with having less.
Yeah, well, people want to sort of travel more, have more experiences than have a rammed closet. And I think that's really becoming more fully entrenched. What's quite interesting for me actually is, you know, for 11 years we've been on this, you know, in this area, and back in the early days, a small amount of what we do is we collect people's clothes and then we sell them, and it's basically to inspire people to buy secondhand clothes and all that, but it's also to make money because we are actually a charity. So we organize these pop-up charity shops and we kind of call on all the rich, wonderful, fashionable women that we know, and we say, hey, can we have your old clothes? We are a charity and we're going to flog them. And in the early days that was really, really easy. And now what's happened is that more and more businesses are starting, like, basically online secondhand designer clothing shops. So we have a lot of competition to get people's decent clothes. And I welcome that competition because what it actually signifies to me is that on a waste perspective, well, it's not even a waste. What it proves to me is that consumers now see the value in their unwanted clothes. And so these rich tie-dyes that we target, they're all going... Well, they don't say it to me directly, but the trend is, you know, they're saying, well, I'm not actually going to give it to you as a charity. I'm actually going to sell it myself or use one of these online businesses that are selling. So the startup world in Hong Kong has changed, and so has the mentality towards consumption cycles, which is a positive thing.
Definitely. I mean, you see that in the vintage market so much in cities, because if I were to go back to Wisconsin, middle of America where I'm from, and shop at the Goodwill or at thrift stores, I can find some incredible gems of like really quality pieces. Whereas if I go places out here where I live in San Diego, it's difficult to find things, and it's surprising the price points when you find something you might want to buy because the competition exists now.
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in what I call these clothing bins, which was part of my 365 challenge, which is when I wore other people's discarded clothes for a whole year, which is actually really good fun. And in order to get discarded clothes, I used to go to these clothing warehouses and spend sweaty hours, you know, depressing hours, actually just rummaging through people's chuck out clothes. Mainly I used to do that in China, Hong Kong, in the bins here, but I also did it in London. And what was interesting there is I was working on a conveyor belt. So the clothes kind of get put on a conveyor belt, and then the staff who operate that clothing warehouse, it's quite interesting actually, there's like a pecking order. So as the conveyor belt comes, the staff are positioned in order of hierarchy, and the order of hierarchy was actually to do with where their charity shops are. So let's just say if Bob has a charity shop in Chelsea, London, you know, where you've basically got very sort of sophisticated, well-off people, then Bob is at the top of the conveyor belt because he will be picking the best stuff for Chelsea, and then down to other regions of the UK where there are lower quality and sort of lower income communities, they're at the bottom of the pecking order on the conveyor belt. I'm not sure if that actually makes sense with what you were saying there. I think maybe that contradicts what you were just saying.
Yeah, I think it's different, but I imagine that the pieces that I would find in the Midwest, they were far older pieces, and that women that you know, were in their 70s or something, were getting rid of. And I would find like an old gem that no one thought was valuable. And so they would value it so much lower. Whereas if that were to make its way to Brooklyn when I lived in New York or somewhere out here in LA area, it would have been far more expensive because there was a different kind of desire for that piece.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, definitely. Actually, on that exact same note, I was in London last weekend, and actually I'm slowly making my way back to live in the UK. And so we've bought a place there, and I was there last weekend, and I bought this place from this woman. She's now 80. She's actually this lady called Lady Hebdige, and she was the chair lady of the Red Cross. And so she is a very influential woman. Anyway, the point is, I was pretty annoyed because we bought this house a few months ago, and basically, she's old, but I was really irritated because she didn't clear out the bloody attic. So I've spent a lot of time actually removing all of her stuff from her family home because she never got around to finishing it. Anyway, the point being, I found this bag of clothes and I was like, gosh, these are lovely. They're like coats from the 70s or 80s, no mothballs. And I just thought that's the exact same thing. You know, these clothes are absolutely beautiful. They're not designer in any way. But clothes back then were made so beautifully. I mean, it can't be the 70s, actually. They're massive shoulder pads. It's 80s. So I'm going to definitely keep those. But I think it's just another reminder that, you know, the generations before us had such incredibly well-made clothes. And now we're starting to see the value of that. Because we haven't had it for most of us as we've grown up. I mean, I'm 38, so I did grow up with decent clothes once upon a time. But most younger people have only grown up not knowing what does quality look like. And often you see the quality in these beautifully made clothes from, you know, other previous generations.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Well, kind of on that note, I wanted to ask you more about the Eco Chic Design Award. That definitely is connecting with the future generation of designers and how they're crafting pieces. So how does that process work? And what's the experience like?
Okay, so the Eco Chic Design Award is our sustainable fashion design competition. And it's now the biggest sustainable fashion design competition in the world. And it's just for emerging fashion designers. And so what we're trying to do with the competition is to really provide a platform where emerging designers who are very, 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 very passionate about sustainable design can shine. So it's each cycle is 9 months, pretty much each of our little babies. And each cycle basically starts with a very deep educational process, which is really why we do the competition. So we're doing that at the moment. It's where we put our heart and soul actually into the education. So we're doing lectures around Asia and Europe. We have online teaching materials. We actually have a teacher training pack. We have 80-ish university partners. And basically what we're trying to do is get education into the university curriculums and push, push, push. So anyway, we do all this education and then the competition kind of kicks off and there's various judging rounds, et cetera, et cetera. And through a very hard process, we finally reach our 10 finalists. And these 10 finalists come from Asia and Europe. We haven't opened up to the US, but we will. Probably 2018, we're opening up to the US, but not now. So the 10 finalists will come from Asia and Europe. And then we bring them to Hong Kong for actually an enormous challenge because they come here for about 10 days and we have different challenges for them every day. And we basically educate them and actually put them to their wits' end. And ultimately, at the end of that experience, we then do a big grand final fashion show at Hong Kong Fashion Week where we select a winner. And the winner, then we tie them up with a retailer and then they produce a collection for retail. So in the past, we've worked with Esprit. So our previous winners have created global rollouts of recycled textile collections, obviously for purchase. And currently, we're working with Shanghai Tang, which is China's leading luxury brand, and they have worked for two cycles with our winners, who then create a collection for them made using Shanghai Tang's own fabric waste. So that's kind of the competition.
That's awesome. Really amazing. And so you have that going on. You have these different consumer-facing kind of projects for education going on, and then you also have a documentary going on?
Yeah, well, we've got a lot going on. When you say it like that, it makes my eyes water. But so on the documentary, yes, what we did over the last 6 years that we've been organizing that competition, what I've genuinely experienced is this enormous energy that emerging designers have. And it's not just Hong Kong, it's not just China, it's actually everywhere. Because we have designers from 42 countries in the last cycle apply, even like places like Kazakhstan, Israel, Serbia, Korea, like countries that don't really, they're not on the tip of our minds as being fashion capitals for sure. So really the reason I say that is because I know for sure, and I know this is truth, that without any question in my mind, younger designers, i.e. emerging designers who are sort of starting their careers, will not partake in the fashion industry as we know it. They definitely are demanding change because they are millennials in their mindset, but they're also fashion designers who will not continue to perpetrate the fashion industry as it is. And so, what's really exciting about having done that, year after year, you meet all these amazing people. You realize that the fashion industry will definitely change unless these people, all go extinct and some sort of meteorite knocks them all out. I don't think that's going to happen, and they will change the fashion industry. So that is why we made the documentary, because we just saw it, and we wanted to create a documentary that would really inspire audiences that there is this new frontier of designer who thinks differently, than the dinosaurs that are kind of running the current industry. And so that's called Frontline Fashion, and that was a labor of love, but we actually did it, and crikey, it was hard, but we succeeded. Because the reason I say it's hard, look, we're actually a charity, we're cobbling together pennies every day. So it's not like to produce a documentary is actually really hard work, even for a commercial enterprise. So anyway, we did it. So it's coming out on iTunes in a month-ish from now. And we're doing also lots of screenings. We've got, I think, 25 screenings happening this month where anyone can screen this documentary. And what's really cool about this documentary is you leave being inspired. You leave knowing that actually the future of the fashion industry is actually quite exciting, and that there are these pioneers, and these pioneers are young designers, and we really experience their passion, and we see that day in, day out, but we show it through this documentary. Because for example, the True Cost documentary, it's this very hard-hitting, very, I mean, it's brilliant. It's an incredible documentary of our times. And what it does is it cracks open the wounds of the world's fashion industry. And quite honestly, most people who watch it just think, oh my goodness, you just can barely breathe at the end of it. Even though I've seen it 5 times, I feel depressed every single time. And so I think what I'm quite excited about our documentary is that it's a solution. In fact, I just this morning emailed Andrew, who's the director of True Cost, to show him our doco because we know him well. And I just this morning sent him our documentary to watch. In fact, he helped us with our documentary as well, with some content and stuff. So that documentary has been great. The other thing we've also just done, which was another hashtag labor of love, absolute hell, is we wrote a book, and it's called Dress with Sense, and it's being published by Thames and Hudson, and it's coming out early 2017, and it's basically a consumer guide to how to dress with sense, and it's a very practical guide about how people like me and you can love, love, love fashion, but do it in a more sustainable and ethical way.
Wow, amazing. And both of these seem to have more of an optimistic outlook. And I see that as so valuable right now because actually, I recently heard from a plethora of students from University of Delaware, actually. Somehow their professor had suggested listening to the podcast, listening to Conscious Chatter. And it was because so many of the students were so depressed. And so, kind of like feeling helpless and feeling numbed by all of the realities that they were having their eyes open to in their fashion courses. And she wanted to have an opportunity for them to see something positive and see that there are people working on projects that have optimistic outlooks and feel like there is a good future in fashion. And so, hearing that about your documentary, I feel like frontline fashion would be so valuable to universities in curriculum.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we did a screening a couple of weeks ago and we had really top industry experts. We had really, I mean, Hong Kong actually is housing some very, very big wigs in the fashion industry because they sit in Hong Kong, but they have their tentacles in China. And people really, A, learned a huge amount from our documentary about what's going on with emerging designers, but also they left really upbeat, like, excellent. You know, they're, of course, there's solutions. You know what? My favorite sort of thought at the moment is that with crisis comes creativity. And I gave a talk last week, actually, and I was like, if there's a crisis, you can either kind of go to bed and give up, or you can find a way around it. And I think we're at that point with the fashion industry. We know that it's a crisis and the environment is an absolute crisis. But do you just want to go to bed or do you want to be part of it? And that is where we're at now. And people are thinking, okay, it's hell. Let's do something about it. Let's innovate and push that creativity and push the innovation and we'll get out of it. And I truly believe that's the only way out of it, is to innovate our way out and to be creative. And I think more people agree with that too. So that's what's getting me out of bed right now. Let's get over it and let's kind of innovate and find these creative solutions out of the problem.
Yeah, that's such a fantastic way of looking at it and such a fantastic mindset.
Yeah. I think also I was going for a walk. I live near the National Park, which is why, you know, I was warning you that my Wi-Fi is pretty bad because I actually don't live in the city anymore. I live on the beach. And I was walking with the dogs a few days ago and I was just really thinking to myself, you know, quite honestly, we often put our heads down in terms of technical solutions and what's, you know, how are we going to reduce carbon and how are we going to do this? And they're all very important questions, but there's a very deeper, or rather much more obvious, philosophical question. And that was this, like, the environment doesn't actually need human beings. We need the environment. You know, I think we sort of forget that actually we're just a blip on this earth and the planet doesn't need us at all. We need the planet. And I think as we start to think about that, it should help us to be a little bit more gracious in the way that we actually treat the planet.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that goes hand in hand with, I always love to hear what my guests have as far as insight and thoughts on how we as everyday people can all be kind of part of this movement and can do our small part and potentially big part to be part of it. What else do you feel like is something really powerful we can all think about?
Well, back in the early days, you know, when I used to hear people say, you know, be the change you want to see in the world and, you know, every little bit counts and all of that. In the early days, I used to thought, oh, I don't believe that. But, you know, 11 years on, I actually truly, truly believe it, that it's, and it sounds so cheesy, but experience has really taught me that it's completely true that we can all make a change by small things that we each do in the comfort of our homes. So I can say number one, and I apologize for the cheese factor, but absolutely all of us have got incredible power to make small changes and make small changes count. So that means that even though the problems may seem insurmountable and absolutely grotesquely complex, we can actually do our own bit. And it doesn't matter how big the problems are, it's still worth doing your own little bit. So that would be one thing that I would say. When it comes to fashion, I would say that consumers need to actually fall in love with their clothes that are in their own closets and really change their perception towards their clothes as being these beautiful things that walk with us through our daily life, and that they are very special garments that we should really actually be grateful for and take good care of them and only buy clothes that you really, 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 really love. So it's not massively insightful, but those are my two pennies worth.
I think it's very insightful. It's interesting because everyone has a different thought on it and a lot of things overlap, but I think the key is, I think we all need to keep thinking about it and we all need to keep hearing different ideas, because the more we have this kind of in our subconscious as well, the more we think about it in the way that we actually act.
Yeah, well, I've got another feeling that I've been having over the last week or so, just in terms of the bigger picture thinking. And I've sort of come to this realization that not doing something is not an option. It's not an option to carry on the way that we are. And so whether that means, you know, someone wants to sort of start recycling or using compost or walking once a week to work, we all have to. We have to do something, even if it's small. So this not doing something is not an option, which is, I think, my kind of inner quote of the week.
Yeah, that's beautiful and good to just keep inside and internalize.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for chatting with me. It's been so lovely learning more about what you're up to, and I'm literally so inspired by the vastness of the work you're tackling. It's really incredible.
Oh, well, that's very sweet of you to say. It's luckily, I love doing it. It's not easy, but I love it, so it's okay.
There's a quote that's been playing on repeat in my brain lately. So much of our future lies in preserving our past. Peter Westbrook's words undoubtedly connect with the stories from next week's guest. Tune in then for our focus on cultural preservation. Cheers to all you changemakers out there. Thanks for listening.